This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
We're really getting into now the streaming arms race.
Dish is looking at that and saying we can really build a nice niche for ourselves.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
The dollar is the dominant currency in the planet.
I think the acquisition is a natural progression of what Microsoft can do with this technology going forward.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
And today, we're going to take a look at inflation and the impact on small caps.
Plus, the ambitious smoke-free transformation at Philip Morris.
All right, let's talk about big tech. You got the fangs, right? You have Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, Netflix, Google. They've all done really, really well. It's kind of where you go when you want to find safety for that sort of longer-term pickup. But if you dig in the details, there are idiosyncratic factors moving all of those big tech stocks. Facebook and Alphabet stand out in terms of their ad revenue. Ad revenue overall has really come back from the depths of the pandemic. So, now what? Want to bring in Mandeep Singh, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Technology Analyst. Set the stage for us first in the last quarter. So how they did, how their comeback was in the ad market.
We have been in this phase where ad spending has been really strong after the second quarter last year. And really all the companies exposed to digital ad spending have done exceptionally well. I think what you're seeing now is somewhat of a divergence that's starting to show up, especially with Alphabet and Facebook. And the reason I say that is because Alphabet, if you think about it, you know, it's exposed to all sectors. It's exposed to travel. It's got YouTube that's really doing well with, you know, the trends around online streaming. In the case of Facebook, it did exceptionally well with the small e-commerce guys who had no other place to go except to come on Facebook. And now it's coming to a point where you can see people aren't using Facebook as much as they are starting to go out. And that is showing up in the impressions growth. So if you think about, you know, top line growth, that's a function of the user growth, impressions growth, and really how much engagement they have. And we know user growth has slowed down. There was some pull forward during the pandemic. The impressions growth is beginning to show those initial signs of, you know, plateauing. And I think that's where we are at right now.
All right. Well, in the last decade or so, when you take a look at some of these social media names, it was just a sit back, focus on the digital ad growth, that the big share shift from traditional media to digital media, and that's all I had to do. I could just start picking stocks out and throw them in a basket, and they're going to do great. But you're saying now I need to do a little bit of homework here?
I think so, and especially the last quarter, all these companies highlighted the fact that they want to bring more creators on the platform. They want more exposure to videos. So there has been a change in narrative in terms of how the digital ad market is evolving. With Facebook, it was all about feeds and, you know, photos, Instagram. Now they want more videos. And the reason they want more videos is they want to bring more creators on the platform. Guess what? YouTube has been doing that for 15 years.
And you mean like original content is what you're talking about?
Original content as well as sponsored content, these shows, because we know people are cord cutting and that's that trend has accelerated. So they're consuming everything on YouTube.
Which ad sales have the biggest premium?
So search has the biggest premium because it drives direct business. Anybody who's searching for a keyword, so Google pays the highest CPCs. Then you have also got display ad spending, and video ad spending has really picked up because the ads that YouTube shows in the middle, advertisers are realizing even though it's brand ad spending, it's not driving actual clicks to your website. It's still very powerful because you're building a brand in the process.
Up until this point, the digital advertising market's really been kind of a duopoly, Facebook and Google. But really over the last several years, we've seen Amazon really focus a lot on that business, put some resources into that business. Where's Amazon in terms of the big digital media ad pie?
Yeah, so Amazon is taking a cut off that search spending I just mentioned. A lot of the searches do start directly in Amazon instead of starting on Google in the desktop era. Now they do start on Amazon, and Amazon has that biggest inventory when it comes to retail.
So more money for Jeff Bezos.
Yes, but I think what Google
so you can go to space.
What Google has done well is really kind of pivoted to YouTube. So YouTube, a lot of people don't realize how big YouTube has become. It's already a $30 billion ad revenue business, just ads. There is separate subscriptions, and it's growing at a 40 to 50% clip.
Wow.
So it's phenomenal in terms of just the execution that they're showing on the YouTube ads.
Have they started disclosing YouTube-specific revenues and profits and things like that? Because for a while there, you kind of felt like the street wasn't giving them proper value for this great asset.
Yes, they have. And we don't know the exact margin profile of the YouTube business. It's probably lower than the search business. But still, the growth rate is off the charts. And the trends will play out at least for the next few years because everyone is switching to, you know, streaming. They're cutting their cable. And you're consuming live sports on YouTube now.
There was a great article on the Bloomberg Terminal that talked about how you could be an influencer and make like $500,000 a year. And you would surpass what you make as a junior banker. Now, influencers are going to use social media. Like, they're using, sure, YouTube, but they're using like Instagram. They're using all the things that I don't know about. Mm-hmm. And Facebook. So why can't Facebook capitalize on that in the same way?
And Facebook is. So Instagram, just to compare YouTube and Instagram, Instagram is also a $30 to $50 billion revenue run rate business growing exceptionally well. Facebook's problem is their core Blue app. That is where you see the plateauing of the trends, user trends. People have stopped or they're using it less and less.
Like the main thing I don't go to anymore.
Exactly.
Okay, just check.
So that's the problem area for Facebook.
Mandeep, such a great pleasure. Always love catching up with you. Mandeep Singh, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Technology Analyst.
Coming up on the program, the keys to outperformance in the industrial sector.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, let's talk industrials right now, specifically industrial bonds. They had a tough time last year in the pandemic. Obviously, the industry shut down, but we've got a reopening trade here. Let's see where the opportunities are in the industrial credit space. We welcome Joel Levington. He's a Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Credit Analyst. All right, so Joel, going into the pandemic, a big shutdown of the industry across the U.S. and the world. A lot of companies raised cash to shore up their balance sheets. How did their balance sheets look now as we're coming out of the pandemic and industrial production's picking back up?
Sure thing, Paul. Yeah, the balance sheets are actually quite strong in the world of industrials, and that's kind of a blessing and a curse for bondholders. Blessing is they throw off a ton of cash, and the curse is that they throw off a ton of cash, which means that they're always doing something, and whether it's portfolio management, higher dividend, share purchases, it becomes a game of capital allocation and who is willing to risk their balance sheet.
So which ones typically do best? Like which ones do you need to be looking at? Is there like a criteria like X amount of leverage? This is the kind of margin.
Yeah, totally, Alex. We did a recent study on it where we looked back over the past 5 years to see who are the outperformers and what are the key themes behind that outperformance. And what we found is that the big winners in the game are the ones that are able to expand margins faster than the peers. And that is usually done through portfolio management. In the world of industrials, it's usually a game of addition by subtraction. So if you get rid of your lowest growing business, your growth rate goes up. And whether that happens or it's through acquisitions of more software-based companies, this is adding to the growth profile and margins, but often at the expense of the balance sheet.
All right. So a lot of companies, including industrial companies, like to reward their shareholders. That's why I went into being an equity analyst, not a debt analyst. So, buying back stock, paying dividends, that type of thing, that's often funded off the balance sheet. How are the industrial companies behaving in that regard right now? Are they managing to their Fitch and S&P ratings, or are they really focusing on their equity shareholders?
I think it's really pedal to the metal for the equity shareholders right now. I think they see an opportunity for growth over the next couple of years, and they are going out and they're at a record pace of acquisitions this year. It's going to be about $320 billion worth of acquisitions. And then, of course, with dividends, to your point, there's some very high dividend players, companies like 3M, Emerson, Dover. These are the dividend aristocrats, I think, are, in your world. And for me, it's the guys that have less debt capacity to do these things without, impeding their credit worthiness.
This might seem like a really plebeian question here, but like, how do you determine, so if they're all doing it, mm-hmm. how do you know which ones are better off doing it and which ones can't? Because you can't avoid them doing it when you have this kind of low interest rate environment.
You're totally right, Alex. And I think it becomes a game of history, knowing the company's long-term financial policies, two, knowing where raters think about the companies and how much debt capacity you have, basically, until you can get into another category. And three, looking at the consistency of their cash flows. So I could take a company like Danaher, where it's 75% of its cash flow is recurring revenue, and you know you have a pretty steady stream. So they can lever up, but they can easily pay it back down, versus maybe more of a machinery company, maybe like a Caterpillar or a Deere, if they're doing acquisition activity, that's very cyclical cash flow, and that can create problems long-term for a bondholder.
So talk to us about the industrial companies. We're hearing about all these logistical problems in the global supply chain, and it's affecting almost every industry out there. How are the industrial companies that have a lot of big input of raw materials, and then, you know, they do all their manufacturing stuff, and then there's an output? How are they dealing with that?
Supply chain has become a really big issue, and COVID has become very, very challenging for them, because you can have companies in Malaysia that are facing COVID to a greater extent than the folks in the United States, and that can delay your product. So really, the companies that manufacture locally have been the ones that have been able to outperform right now.
Mm, right, that makes sense. You don't have to transport as far, et cetera. Quick question here. So we talked about this with oil stocks a few weeks ago, that a lot of oil companies were borrowing money to pay back debt, or using a lot of their free cash flow to pay back debt, but they already paid it back. So now they're like, they're paying it back early and they had to pay a premium for it, et cetera. Is that happening in industrials?
No, industrials, because they do generate a lot of cash flow, they tend to not look to pay off debt early and wind up having to pay either a make-whole fee or some sort of premium for it, whereas something like on the energy side, because of the volatility and all of the bankruptcies that they've kind of gone through, I think maybe they've gained a little bit of religion and have decided to pay down debt while they still can.
Fair enough.
All right, so the world's looking for yield. Where's the relative value in your space, Joel? I'm thinking that, you know, there's big industrial companies, the mm-hmm. credit profiles there. Where's the relative value?
Yeah, it's hard to find, Paul, okay. But the names that I like is everything is relative. You have to put your money to work somewhere. Long-dated Carrier bonds, Carrier, the maker of HVAC equipment, so yep. air conditioning and heating. General Electric long-dated bonds are another place
really?
That I like to be. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, so they're not, those are the GE bonds on the industrial side, because they've gotten rid of the vast majority, if not all of their financial side.
They have gotten rid of their the majority of the financial side. You're totally right there. But all the bonds are guaranteed by the parent. Okay. So it doesn't particularly matter what the name is. It's all GE exposure anyway. But they're longer dated bonds, meaning bonds 10 years or longer in maturities. That's where you find the value. Up front in their credit curve, they trade tight to their ratings. And they are still maybe a year or a year and a half away from getting anywhere near looking like the profile that they have for the ratings that they have.
Mm-hmm. So let's just pretend that the Fed raises rates at some point. We go up 50, 75 basis points. What happens to these guys?
Well, I think you'd probably have a mixed result for many of them. If you have the Fed raising rates, in theory, that's because growth is accelerating, mm-hmm. Which is a good thing for somebody in an industrial cyclical space. So it's not as bad as it seems. Obviously, if you're a bondholder, you'd want to be in shorter dated bonds and longer dated bonds, all else being equal. But if you're having, in theory, better cash flow and leverage protection measures, that might be an offset, that it might minimize the downside there.
Talk to us about, you know, there's been so much new issuance in the investment grade credit market and high yield everywhere.
Yes.
If I'm a bond buyer, if I'm a bondholder, do I have any leverage in terms of negotiating covenants, or do I just take it?
You take it.
There's, yep.
there's not a lot of options. Even very simple deals are oversubscribed 5 or 6 times. So wow. You take it, you get your few basis points on a flip, and that's about it.
When you have that kind of situation, are we in a high risk profile, or is it okay? Because a lot of these guys have just so much money.
You know, I think there is risk that's building, because everybody is expecting the world to be fine and great and continue to accelerate growth. And when everybody is betting on one side of the table, mm-hmm. it always makes me think about the other side. And right now, everybody is very bullish and long, putting aside the one issue that you have in China right now. Everybody is, like I said, pedal to the yep. metal and very excited about growth. And that makes me say, you know, if you can buy a high quality name or a lower quality name at same prices, now's the time to get more conservative, because eventually risk comes around.
See, spoken like a true credit analyst. Totally. Joe Levington, Bloomberg Intelligence, Senior Credit Analyst.
All right, coming up on the program, we're going to look at the inflationary impact on the small cap space.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It is 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we're going to be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts, covering some 2,000 companies in 130 industries worldwide.
So inflation is most definitely here. The question is it transitory or is it more sustainable? And then what is the impact on individual sectors? The concern is that you're going to see negative earnings revisions as margins get compressed, whether or not inflation is transitory or not. So what does that mean for the guys like small cap? Joining us now is Michael Casper, Bloomberg Intelligence Equity Strategist. Okay, what does it mean for small caps? Because typically, if you have inflation, small caps do pretty well.
Yeah, so historically, small caps' relative performance to the S&P 500 is highly correlated to rising CPI and PPI to the tune of about 0.21 and 0.30 to each, respectively. And right now, we've got pretty much a decoupling of small caps and these inflation expectations and actual inflation prints. This is giving us a read on the economy and that GDP growth is likely to be a little bit more disappointing and that we're in a period of more cost push inflation or supply side driven inflation.
Because what we hear a lot of companies tell us during their earnings conference calls is, yes, we are seeing inflation in our cost structure. And then the next question is from an analyst, how much are you able to pass along to your end user? And depending upon the sector, there's different answers. Small caps, my thought would be they'd have less opportunity to pass it along. What's your research shown?
Yeah, typically they have less pricing power than their large cap competitors. Their margins do typically, though, improve in periods of higher inflation, and that's the main pathway that small caps do tend to outperform in periods of higher inflation. But this time, if it's cost push, maybe it's more of a 2011 type situation where inflation was still rising. GDP growth started to decelerate a little bit, possibly because of the debt ceiling crisis that was going on at the time. And it indicated a period of general weakness for stocks.
Is this different than what we typically see in large cap stocks?
Not really. They typically both tend to do well in periods of inflation. But again, we're really stressing the point that if this is more cost push inflation than demand driven inflation, neither is really going to benefit too much.
Hmm. All right. So I know you and the Gina Martin Adams team at Bloomberg Intelligence, you guys do a lot of work sectors and looking at different sectors and sector scorecards. So in a small cap world, are there certain sectors that you guys think might be better positioned here?
Yeah. So we looked at debt to equity levels of all the sectors in the small cap space, and utilities, discretionary, industrials, staples are the most levered right now. Versus their own history, though, tech is actually kind of bubbling up in the debt ratios category. So that could be an issue if the Fed starts taking more of a hawkish stance amongst this higher inflation backdrop.
What about factors?
Oh, yeah. So high leverage as a factor had done fantastic since the 2020 bottom. Mm. In fact, it outperformed by quite a bit. And looking back to mid-June when the Fed started increasing the chatter of, you know, we're possibly going to have to raise rates at some point, we're possibly going to have to taper at some point, that factor's underperformed by 43 basis points. So I think that's just a preview of what is possibly to come for the high leverage factor, especially if the Fed does have to act to combat inflation.
All right, so I'm looking at the Russell 2000 up about 11% year-to-date, lagging the S&P a little bit. What's really the call here for small caps? I mean, do I want to be overweight small caps if I think there's this reopening trade and we're going to get the Delta variant under control and the numbers are going to start really trending much better?
Well, what it looks like right now in the revenue growth numbers, at least based on consensus expectations, is that they're pretty much going to match large cap revenues. And that's an issue for small caps. If you think about small cap stocks, they're higher risk than their large cap counterparts. You really got to have a strong growth backdrop to justify dipping your toes into the higher risk small caps. So unless those expectations improve markedly, you're probably going to want to stay more neutralish on the small caps.
So let's break it down a little more in terms of the relationship with CPI and PPI, because both of the inflationary impulses, one's producer price index, the other one's consumer price index. Is there one that small caps track mostly that we can kind of use on like a real-time indicator feel?
Well, yeah, they typically follow PPI more strongly. Again, about 0.3 correlated to PPI, the relative performance of small versus large. But within the styles, value and growth, there's actually a big divergence there. Value stocks typically track much closer with CPI than growth stocks, whereas both typically do well in that rising PPI environment. So, you know, and that's via things like tech and healthcare not really tracking CPIs that closely. So PPI tends to be a measure that would lift all boats, whereas CPI tends to be a measure that, you know, might have a positive effect for value and less of a positive effect for growth.
Valuation. Am I getting a break on valuation if I take on the small cap risk?
A little bit. So small caps are undervalued compared to large caps, clearly, to the tune of, you know, anywhere between 1 and 2 standard deviations at the moment. So there is that valuation opportunity there. However, our recent fair value models suggest that there's not much room for absolute multiple expansion within the small cap space. And that's kind of been part of the reason that we've been in this range trade since March.
Yeah, fair enough. All right, Michael, thanks a lot. That's Michael Casper, Bloomberg Intelligence Equity Strategist.
Coming up on the program, Philip Morris goes smoke-free, plus the outlook for grocery spending habits.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
So are you eating out or are you cooking? I still not have eaten indoors in a restaurant
really?
Yet. I know.
Okay, I'm not, no pressure, but no,
I know,
it
I'm
works.
Slowly getting there, but okay. I'm doing a lot more cooking, which could be a good sign for, say, the packaged food company. So let's get a read on that with Diana Rosero-Pena, Bloomberg Intelligence Equity Research Analyst. Diana, are there a lot of people like me, like the packaged food sales, doing really well because I'm too scared to eat out?
Well, it seems like they are. We received latest IRI data, and it seems that sales growth for packaged food companies continue to be strong for many key categories, such as soups, chocolate.
So, Diane, everybody who comes in there, I have to ask my supply chain question. Are the food manufacturers, the packaged good manufacturers, are they able to get stuff on the shelves? Because remember back at the beginning of the pandemic, we had empty shelves, and we've never seen that. What's the status today?
Well, it's definitely they have gotten a hold of their supply chain, and out of stocks seem to be a thing of the past. So we probably won't see any out of stocks or significant out of stocks for the foreseeable future. One of the things that is a worry is inflation. That is like the second question for supply chain. So, and that is also that is a worry. And one of the things that we have noticed on the data is that volumes were pretty strong across key categories, but also you're starting to see low single digit increases in unit prices. We still expect higher price increases towards the end of the year, because obviously these packaged food companies, once they get all their input costs, then they're starting to do negotiations with the retailers. So we should start to see a little bit more inflation coming to the consumer towards the end of the year.
Okay, so good for them because they can pass on the price increases. Which companies can do that the best and can sustain that pricing power and have the strong demand? And which ones are a little bit more dicey?
Well, you can see that, for example, for chocolate, I mean, right now we're eating our feelings, and Halloween is around the corner.
I totally eat my feelings and I drink them.
So obviously, you have Hershey that is one of the market share bellwethers. So definitely they are more comfortable passing price increases to retailers. And then you have a little bit more competitive center of the store categories, such as soup, that they might have a little bit of difficulties passing those costs through.
Reading your research, I found this fascinating. Pet food sales. big winner. Is that because during a pandemic, everybody went out and got a dog or a cat, and that's driving sales?
Absolutely. That is, yes. So last year, pet adoptions increased 6% in the U.S. So obviously that is significant. That expanded the pie. And because people are staying more at home, then you can probably see that they feed their dogs a little bit more. Though I would say snacks is actually will beat pet food, because people give more snacks to their dogs than, you know, the regular food.
Is that right? That makes sense. Okay, I buy that. So what's doing poorly? You mentioned sort of the center of the store stuff, like soups and things like that. What kind of brands are we talking about? What companies?
So cereal seems to be having a little bit of difficulty retaining some of the customers that they gained last year. They are actually declining in the low to mid single digits over the course of the past few months. You will see that it's also compared to low single digit increase in that they experienced in 2020. And then you have a soup that they actually increased in September, at the beginning of September, about 9%, the category as a whole, which is obviously a lot better than what they have, that they have experienced before the pandemic. And that is, it can be attributed to people being more comfortable with cooking and using soup as a level to be able to prepare meals.
All right, thanks so much, Diana Rosero Pena, Bloomberg Intelligence equity analyst.
All right, let's talk sustainability, a big, big issue for investors. It's a topic that continues to get a lot of press. A lot of industries having some tough times selling that sustainability story, and that's including the tobacco business. Let's welcome Louise Parker, Bloomberg Intelligence credit analyst. So Louise, let's talk about Philip Morris, the big, big player. It's talked a lot about sustainability. What really is their sustainability plan, and how do they get there, given that their products, not well received by many parts of society?
Yeah. Hey guys. Thanks for having me on today. Yeah, it's on ethical grounds, right off the bat, a lot of investors just won't touch tobacco. So companies, you either can or you cannot, and that's one thing. But sustainability, all companies are looking at how to improve and how to boost their sustainability. About 5 years ago, Philip Morris had a plan to completely transform their business. And they have a target of generating about 25%. It is 25% of revenues. So it's a $30 billion revenue business. And by 2025, they want 25% of their sales to be from smoke-free products. And they're almost halfway there. Just at the half-year stage, they're at 29% of sales. So still, 70% of sales are still coming from cigarettes, which is about $21 billion annually. But their point is they want to transform the company away from tobacco into something smoke-free.
So
it's going to take them years to do it.
Yeah.
And there's, tobacco is still, it's an addictive product. Nicotine is addictive. But that's really their plan. It's to transform the entire business.
So, Louise, when we're looking at their success rate or non-success rate, is it seen more in the equity or in the credit?
That's a really good question, Alex. It's a story across both equity and credit, but my angle here as a credit analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence is looking at this because they've just published their new financing framework, which actually ties in their sustainability key performance metrics and something which is a little acronym that they call their sustainable performance targets directly to the business plan. So they're saying, and to the funding pricing of their bonds. They haven't yet done a green bond, but that's the future. That's why they've put this huge framework in place. And it's quite a weighty tome. It's on the company website. And all I've done in the research report I've written is to just pull out some key pieces. I mean, for instance, executive compensation is tied to achieving these targets. And then when they go into the market to fund their first green bond or green loan, sustainable loan or sustainable bond, they will have step-ups such that the coupon will increase if they don't meet these metrics. So it has to be measurable, it has to be verifiable, and it has to be independently verified. And so there are all these things they have to, all these hoops they have to jump through to show their sustainability and to show the seriousness of their plan. And I've never seen a tobacco major do this before. So it's the first, I think, and it could open up, you know, the floodgates for other tobacco companies to look at funding this way.
Hey, Louise, how about M&A? If I wanted to get to 50% of my sales non-tobacco, I could just go out and buy a food company or a beverage company. Is that something that they would consider?
Yeah,
is that something the market would...
I don't know how familiar you are with the tobacco majors, but Altria used to own Philip Morris, and they had the divorce back at the beginning of the 2000s. And if you even go back to the late 90s, the Master Settlement Agreement, where they're paying billions of dollars to fund, in the US, to fund state health care for people with illnesses related to tobacco. So there's a lot of history behind this. They used to own, Altria used to own Kraft. I mean, all these businesses that have they've spun out. So, would they go back? Well, everyone knows RJR and Nabisco. Well, RJR is now part of British American Tobacco. So they've been there, done that, and actually figured out for their shareholders mostly, they've spun those businesses out to shareholders to benefit the shareholders and really to divorce the tobacco risk and the litigation risk and the regulation risk from the food businesses. And so they've been successful at that. Now, if you just sort of take a step back, tobacco companies are cash cows. And so if you can invest, if for ethical reasons you can invest in tobacco, they have really good dividend yields, upwards 10% for the UK companies. So it is attractive if you can invest in tobacco, and even on the debt side, they pay more and their spreads are wider. If you look at any of my valuation notes on the majors that I cover, the tobacco names I cover, you will always get a wider spread for the tobacco names because of that risk of litigation and of regulation. But jumping back to the question on M&A, this is really where the greenwashing and my headline of the research I wrote this week comes in. Greenwashing is just, it's a catch-all phrase, but it really means that we don't believe you. When you talk about sustainability, we're not quite sure.
Yeah.
And now Philip Morris has bought two businesses. One is called Fertin, and they spent, it's only a couple of billion they've actually spent on these businesses, and one is Vectura. Now, the one, Vectura actually is, they got control of the company in the past week. And the offer is now unconditional to shareholders, which means that every asset manager has to sell. Now, there's two sides to this story. Asset managers are being accused of greenwashing by selling what is effectively a healthcare company. Vectura makes drug inhalers. So if you think that you might be a smoker, you might have problems with your lungs, you have an inhaler to take a special medicine. Right. Well, Philip Morris could sell you the cigarettes that made you sick in the first place, and then, hey, they can sell you the inhaler to help you get better or to help you improve your breathing. And that's really where greenwashing comes in.
Thank you very much for joining us, Louise Parker, Bloomberg Intelligence credit analyst. That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.